need order. In attendance, we have Representatives Gatto, Olson, Rammer, Samuels, Seaton, and Elkins. Continuing discussions on House Bill 2004. And the plan for today is to try to get to the questions that were asked by the committee members yesterday. And with that, Donahue? Donahoe or Donahue?
Donahue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Office of Attendance, we have Representative Crawford.
My name is Joseph Donahue. I'm with Preston Gates and Ellis, and been working with the Department of Law on the SGDA conforming amendments bill. I apologize that Kevin Jardel is right now working on the written document that we hope to have ready by now and should be ready very shortly. One portion of that document related to the...
Can you turn the mic up just a little bit?
What?
I can't hear very well.
Yes. One portion of a written response basically is a recommendation that the in-state use of gas series of questions that arose yesterday be addressed to Bob Leffler of Morrison & Forster, and he's agreed to be available during this time to answer your questions directly. I do not have the written response with me because Kevin is finishing the typing and making copies.
Do you want to defer to him or wait until he gets here, or
I can answer a couple of the questions that I think are the relatively easy ones.
You've got the list of questions there. If you can kind of start going through maybe what the question was and what the response is, and then when we get the written comments, we can go down that road.
The first question, I don't have the list of questions, but the first question that I recall and I know is in the written response is we were asked what is the whether there was a term limit on the representatives appointed to the municipal advisory group. The municipal advisory group is an informal entity. It's created by statute. It's essentially formed at the time an application is submitted under the SGDA. The Commissioner of Revenue notifies affected municipalities. The mayor of the municipality appoints a representative, and the representative serves at the pleasure of the mayor. So there's no specific term limit in the state statute. So it would be subject to, again, the discretion of the mayor of each municipality. The proposed amendment that appears in HB 2004, and it's in section 15, deals with extending the life of the MAG itself. The MAG ceases to exist under current law at the time the final action is made with regard to the application that the advisory group is formed to address. So the under the current law, the MAG entity would disband, would no longer serve the statutory purpose at the time the legislature authorizes the proposed contract under the SGDA statutory provisions. The proposed amendment would extend the life of the municipal advisory group through the end of the distribution of the impact payments, which are provided for under Article 18 of the proposed fiscal contract, which is a six-year period following project sanction, or with the commencement of commercial operations of the pipeline, whichever comes first.
Okay. Questions on the municipal advisory group? Representative Seaton.
Was that whichever comes first or whichever comes last? I mean, as I read it, it says the latter of 90 days after final distribution. Or are you saying the contract says 6 years or?
No, I stand corrected. It's the later of the two events.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember the other
major. Might give Jardell a call again and see how long he's going to be.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I left my last copy upstairs.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. These communities that are having the impact, and we're going to essentially send them some money to take care of the impact during construction, but does not the impact linger long after the startup? It isn't like when the pipeline starts up, all the impact kids and all the impact events disband immediately. So what happens in a community that says, we're still having this problem?
Under the proposed fiscal contract, I believe the impact monies that are provided by the midstream entities will pay out over a six-year period up to $125 million. To the extent that there are impacts after that, the state would have to deal with that either through its own grant program or many of the political subdivisions that are in fact impacted will have revenue producing PILTs directed to them. So the North Slope Borough, for instance, Fairbanks, there will be a constant stream of revenue based on the completed project. So there will be an opportunity for the political subdivisions to offset those impacts with that revenue, which is kind of the normal process. During the construction period, it's somewhat abnormal because there's a limitation on the ability of the political subdivisions to impose taxes.
Continue. Just through the sheer inertia of a project this size, I'm really expecting that even though there's a startup, and there would be years before we would see a revenue stream from which to take money to continue to service impact money.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, once project sanction, that decision is made, it is in everybody's interest, the producer's interest, the state's interest, to complete that project as quickly as possible. So there's opportunities for delay, but...
No, I'm just thinking the project is now done, but the impact won't go away all that quickly. The impact to any community could say, listen, the impact money just disappeared. The project has just started up. But we still have a lot of things in place that haven't gone away yet, and I'm not expecting them to go away for conceivably ever or at least years or a certain while enough without having a lot of experience that none of us, I guess, have had on projects of this size, whether or not that maybe impact money ought to continue or taper down rather than just end. Do you have a thought on that?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, I really don't have a comment on that. I believe the schedule of payments in Article 18 does in fact taper off, but it doesn't address your question of what if there's impacts beyond that period. Beyond the period of the contractual payments.
However, the property tax money would start to flow once the gas starts to flow.
Yes.
So that would go to the impact community also. So this starts, the impact money is for the construction phase, assuming that you stretch it out long enough that when gas flows, then you start to get property tax money on the entity.
Yes.
Thank you.
You don't get the property tax money when the property is improved?
And on the value, because the value won't be there.
Exempts the producers from tax increases.
The value would increase until it ramps up or doesn't get value until it is actually built and operated. So I'm going to assume that's correct. Another question from our friends from the back of the room. Representative Seaton.
And I think we have to remember that under the contract, it's payment in lieu of taxes, so there won't be a property tax. It will be a payment in lieu of property taxes. And I guess the question is, if it's 6 years following project sanction, is that the schedule for throughput to start? Is it years after the project sanction? Or do we have a gap there?
I think that's the best estimate of the construction period. But again, I think it's Representative Seaton. I think it's in everybody's interest to beat that schedule.
And six should probably be more than enough. Actually, the construction should actually be shorter. Famous last words. Now, do you want to wait for Mr. Jardel with the rest of the questions, or and speak of the devil? Mr. Dodell, we went through the Municipal Advisory Group question and the impact payments, but if you can go through, I didn't have a list of the questions that we asked, but if
sure. We compiled a list and we'll walk through them.
We have more copies.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, is this two, one each?
Wish.
Okay, with that, we've gone through number one. So if we can just start in on with number two.
Let me start, Mr. Chairman, Kevin Jardel, Legislative Director for Governor Murkowski. Thank you for waiting. I apologize for the delay. We've been trying to pull these together last night and pull them together this morning. There are two questions that were brought up yesterday that we have not answered yet. We've asked our attorneys to go through. We want to ensure that we get the best answer to you.
Okay.
One of those was on state sovereignty and whether the state had ever waived it to a degree of allowing itself to be sued in other jurisdictions. And examples of those, we're doing a thorough research to make sure, and we can provide that information to you. And the other one, there was a question on permanent fund assets, and we're researching that today.
Okay.
And should have that this afternoon. So with that, I'll turn it over to Joe and walk through them. If there are other questions that we've missed and we didn't take notes, please bring them to our attention, and we'll try to get them answered as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, turning to the question number two on this written response, this is the question of whether a tax rate that's incorporated into a PILT that is authorized by the legislature, a contract has been finally authorized by the legislature, could the state in subsequent administration, subsequent years, negotiate a different rate with the taxpayers? And the administration's position is that would not be that there's no room, no leeway for material amendments to the contract in subsequent years. There is, however, a section in the proposed contract that deals with amendments to the fiscal contract, and that is Article 39.1, and that's a fairly standard in commercial contracts or contracts of any kind, which basically says that the terms of the contract could be modified by mutual agreement in writing. So there's theoretical possibility that future administrations could agree to something different, a different tax rate than the one proposed and the one authorized initially by the legislature. In our response, we've suggested some language that might address that concern. Basically, we would propose adding to 4382.435 some language that would make it clear, number one, that amendments to the contract are permitted without coming back to the legislature for future authorization, except for those provisions which relate to tax payments in lieu, either taxes or payments in lieu of taxes, that have been proposed and agreed to under the terms of 4382-210A, which is the laundry list of all the taxes that can be modified, converted to a PILT, what have you. So this language would protect the state from going forward with a contract that could be modified theoretically in the future, should the administration at that time decide that was in the best interest of the state. They would have to come back under this language. They'd have to come back to the legislature and seek approval.
Thank you.
Section number three, or question number three, was related to what are some examples of the modifications of lease agreements and unit agreements that are contemplated by the expanded authority that we've proposed by amendments to 4382.020 and to 220. We've gone to the Department of Natural Resources and talked to Deputy Commissioner there, or received this response from the Deputy Commissioner. And I think the question initially was focused on unit agreements, and the best example of modification of the unit agreements is the example that I gave yesterday, which is the Point Thompson article in the proposed contract. As I think I mentioned, there was an ongoing dispute between the lessees of that unit and the state as to whether or not they have properly pursued development of those leases in that unit. And the article in the proposed contract suspends that dispute for a period of time, sets a schedule for development of Point Thompson pursuant to the kind of the project plan. And so to the extent that there is a dispute about the rights and obligations and duties of the lessees, that is probably the primary example of modifications of a unit agreement. In the first paragraph to the response, there's a list of modifications to oil and gas lease agreements that are contemplated by the proposed contract. These deal with providing that the state would cover cleaning, gathering, dehydration costs that would not otherwise be contemplated by the lease. It deals with the responsibility to pay for the disposition of impurities, which is again an exception to the normal rule. There's limitation on the right of the state under the normal oil and gas lease to switch back and forth between royalties in value and royalties in kind. There's a adjustments to the alternative royalty rate for certain sliding scale royalty leases. So these are examples of both modifications to oil and gas leases and to unit agreements that would be covered by the changes to 4382-220.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On number six, they're providing an optional alternative for royalty rate for sliding scale royalty leases. Is that actually a modification of the royalty rates? Does that allow a modification for royalty rates?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I am not conversant with the actual details of these modifications. Generally speaking, it sounds like I think the answer is yes. There's an option to do something different than what was contemplated in the initial oil and gas lease. But we would have to talk to the commissioner or to the people in DNR to get you an answer on that.
We can get that answer. I believe that had to do with the certain leases that are the net profit share leases that are already in existence.
Mr.
General leases at Kapark and Prudhoe and Alpine and the rest of them, but there are some that are sliding scale depending on the profit of the company already. Okay. So not net profit share lease, they had to address. And I'm getting and once again, but these people will be able to answer our questions further. Okay.
But I would like to note that I would like a a definition of parameters around number six and what that could allow as far as changes in royalty rates by the commissioner under the contract.
Okay.
You know, for further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's the one I had highlighted myself.
Oh, okay.
Okay, moving on to number four.
Section four is the question that relates to in-state use of gas. And
Mr.
again,
Leffler.
We would.
Mr. Leffler online yet? No?
Check. He's calling in.
Okay. Do you want to skip number four with the in-state use there, Mr. Jardel?
Please.
Okay.
Thank you,
going to Mr. number five.
The question was posed yesterday in connection with changes to the kind of the catch-all provision in 4382-200, which authorized the Commissioner of Revenue to negotiate commercially reasonable terms and terms that were in the long-term fiscal interest of the state, substituting long-term fiscal interest for the state's best interest. And we were asked to go find case law on what best interest of the state means versus what long-term fiscal interest of the state means. And the short, we've provided a fairly complete summary of those two terms. The short answer is, well, there is no case law that we can find on what long-term fiscal interest means. It is a term of art that's consistently used throughout the SGDA in a number of places, but it has never been litigated. We cannot say with any certainty what it means. On the other hand, the best interest of the state has been litigated, that term has been litigated within the state of Alaska. And it's generally been found to relate to the constitutional duty under Article 8 of the Constitution to develop the resources for the maximum use consistent with public interest, and to utilize all resources belonging to the state for the maximum benefit of the people. There's two different provisions at the outset of Article 8 that, in essence, require the development of state resources for the maximum benefit of the people. This, again, in the context of litigation between the Department of Natural Resources and parties opposing some of their decision-making, that there is a body of case law defining best interests of the state. There's no body of case law defining long-term fiscal interest.
And just for members' edification, we've just got from Ledge Legal discussion on the same topic that just was handed out a second ago. Okay.
If I may add, there's I think it's still worthy of consideration to substitute long-term fiscal interest for best interest, because the entire SGDA process is focused on fashioning a fiscal regime that both the state and the producers can live with over the long haul. And to the extent that each one of these terms can be justified either by that or by the language in 200A7 as something necessary or reasonable and appropriate for the implementation of the various provisions of the Act, such as obtaining an equity interest, taking your oil and taking your production tax payment in kind, and committing to shipping positions on the project. So we do believe the language that we've proposed provides greater flexibility, but we cannot say that long-term fiscal interest is well documented in the case law.
Representative Ledoux.
Would there be any problem in changing the other statute where it refers to long-term fiscal interests of the state, rather than changing this to make it the long-term fiscal interest of the state? In order to make it consistent with the other statute, why not change the other statute to make it consistent with best interests of the state?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, because we have already made preliminary findings under that statute, it would be, we think it would be problematic to change the standard after those standards have already been utilized and the contract is out to the public for review. And so we do think there would be a problem with going back and changing the standard that has already been utilized to issue those findings.
Follow-up?
Yes.
You think there'd be any different findings if you'd used best interests of the state than if you used long-term fiscal interests of the state?
Through the chair, as you read through this, I think what you'll notice that Department of Law views the long-term fiscal interests as a narrower definition than the best interests. And so I do not believe that would change the commissioner's decisions. However, I think it would certainly cast questions as to whether or not you had to begin the process anew or what exactly that would entail from a process and procedural standpoint. So I don't think it would be substantive changes, but I think it could very well be cause some questions and concerns over what does it mean if you've changed it to the process as we go forward. If I could follow up with two other points that I think are important as we go through here, because we didn't just research the case law, we also went back and researched the minutes of the Stranded Gas Act to see if there was any direction from the legislature as they debated and discussed the original act. And we could not find any direction as to why there would be two different standards. But looking at that, that we can't find any direction, and then based on the Department of Law's review that the best interest is a broader standard than the more narrow one, we think the consistency would actually just answer the question that, yes, keep consistent, keep the standard in place, and move forward. And so we think there's still value in that. Is it necessarily something that is absolutely critical? Like we said, we think it's broader, so it may not be critical, but it does really pose the question, did the legislature intend it? What did they intend? And there is no answer.
Representative Gatto.
Is not the long-term fiscal interest included in a best interest?
Through the chair, we think it would be, because as you stated, the long-term interest is a more narrow finding than the broader best interest.
So would you say we lose nothing by staying with best interest since we already include long-term fiscal interest?
Through the chair, I think there's value in establishing a clear process and procedure that doesn't open up questions as to why the legislature wanted us to use one standard in one place, a more narrow one, and then broaden it out to the other standard when you before you submit the contract. There is no answer to the question of as to why it was done that way. The question is, is it just a drafting issue? Was there an intent to have a different standard? What was that different standard? There is no direction. And so by allowing it to remain, you allow that question to be asked, potentially litigated, and when we're looking at preliminary findings that we've already issued and that everybody can look at and read and get a grasp on, we look at it and say, well, if you're making preliminary findings, you should move those findings to final findings. And we think continuing with the standard makes sense, answers that question, and provides a more efficient and thorough process.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that when the legislature used two different terms, they're and weren't clear, and there's nothing to fall back in the records, that at that point you're supposed to fall back to the most basic, which is our Constitution, and it's fairly clear that the Constitution says that the best interest of the state and maximum benefit to the people of the state. So it would seem to me that rather than change it to the long-term interests of the state, let's use a defined term, which is the best interests of the state. I feel perfectly comfortable going with something that's in the best interest of the state, even if there was a case where, okay, we might take less money for 4 or 5 years because we were going to get it for 20 years longer. You could make the case in a court that that actually is in the best interest of the state. I don't think that what we want is to be able to make the case that, well, it's in the best, I mean, it's in the interest of the state to take, you know, less money for 25 or 30 years because we might not get another chance to get a pipeline.
Through the chair, I disagree that you fall back to the Constitution. We start with the Constitution. That's an overriding principle that we have to comply with regardless of what state statute says. And so the provisions that you cite in the Constitution are always in force and are always controlling over this contract, regardless of what standards we set in the statute, the legislature sets in the statute. So we always comply with that. This really gets to when the commissioner is supposed to make findings under a standard. What standard should the commissioner use? And the legislature said when you make your preliminary decision, you should do it in the long-term fiscal interests. It makes sense if you look at the context of the Stranded Gas Act when it was introduced and as it's been amended, because its focus is on the economics of the project. The purpose was to negotiate a deal that changed the economics so that we could market our gas. The fiscal nature of the Stranded Gas Act seems to make some sense. So we made preliminary findings. So now it is, do you really want, when you get to the final, do you want a lesser standard? Do you want to broaden it out to where you don't really need the best or the long-term fiscal interests? Now maybe you could do what you suggested wouldn't be good and say, well, it's going to extend TAPS for 20 to 30 years, increase production on the through the oil TAPS pipeline. And that's in the best interest of the state, and so we're going to find it okay. Long-term fiscal interests is a more narrow definition. It's actually a higher standard. But for us, it's one that is consistent, and so we don't have to go through and ask the question and answer the question, why the difference?
No, I can't.
Representative Gatto.
Well, I almost feel like I'm being repetitive, but in the Constitution, it doesn't use the term best interest, but it does use the term maximum benefit.
Could you say that again, please?
The Constitution, are you serious? Doesn't use the term best interest. Maximum benefit is the term that's used. Now, long-term fiscal, we're making those terms up. And while we, like you say, we don't, the Constitution is the overriding principle, but I don't see it in the Constitution as best interest, because best interest could be jobs, it could be maintaining infrastructure, there could be several things that are not in the long-term fiscal stability, interest, benefit, or any other term. Personally, I wouldn't mind saying, putting in best interest, including long-term fiscal interest, rather than putting one without the other.
We assume there will be two amendments tomorrow, one going one way and one going the other?
If
you don't have to comment on that. That wasn't a question, but if you'd like to.
I hesitate to.
We can
discuss it if it comes up.
And I'm sure that it will. Moving on to number six.
Number six was a question related to taxation of LLCs, specifically the LLCs that would own some of the project segments.
Can you put the microphone to you, sir?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Number six is a question that was raised about whether or not LLCs could be subject to a corporate income tax in the future, and specifically whether or not the limited liability companies that are formed to own some of the project segments, such as the main line, such as the gas treatment plant, could be subject to revisions to the corporate income tax. As a kind of a general theoretical matter, the state could probably impose corporate income tax on limited liability companies. But specifically with regard to these companies would be protected by the fiscal stability provisions in Article 11. They would be exempt from the corporate income tax.
So if Conoco sells their portion of the pipeline to the Crawford Pipeline Company, and the Crawford Pipeline Company becomes a member of the LLC, they're on the hook to pay taxes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm talking now about the limited liability company that is formed to own, let's say, the main line.
I understand. If Conoco sells their portion of the main line pipe, so they're one-third of 80%, however the math works out, and the Crawford Pipeline Company or Crawford Gas or just Harry Inc. comes in and buys that portion, so they're now a member of the LLC, the revenues from the LLC are going to flow down to Crawford Inc., mm-hmm. and Crawford Inc. is now on the hook for the corporate income tax, and they're not exempt from anything, no PILTs, they're not exempt from anything. Conoco, those revenues go to Conoco, and they just pay their corporate income taxes. Is that all true statements?
The ConocoPhillips entity that owns a membership interest in the mainline LLC, that entity would be affiliated with the production company, possibly the parent, and it's part of a unitary business which files a corporate income tax under the PILT provision. I think it's Article 19. It's called SCIT, the state's corporate income tax. That affiliate is subject to corporate income tax, subject to a PILT. There's a lot of small differences, but the main difference is that the SCIT, Article 19, locks in the corporate income tax as of October 2005. Now, if ConocoPhillips affiliate who owns the membership interest in the LLC assigns that to an entity that is not affiliated with the producer, then that entity inherits some of the rights under the contract, except for the corporate income tax. So a unaffiliated new entrant to an LLC would be subject to corporate income tax. I think the way it actually works, it begins with the SCIT, but there's no guarantee that would be limited. So it could change during the life for that particular company.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
LLCs in the state do not pay income tax. So taking the example of, let's say, Berkshire Hathaway or somebody else that comes in, and their only business in the state is under this contract, and their only business is as an LLC member, they have no other business in the state. The distribution through that LLC, are they going to be required under this contract to file separate income tax?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. Yes, they would be subject to corporate income tax. They would have to pay. They'd have to file and pay based on their own activities in the state of Alaska.
Even if those even if those activities are totally limited to this LLC activity that's covered under the contract, because normally LLCs do not pay any income tax on the distribution. The corporations, if they're here and they have other activities, they're filing corporate income tax.
That is correct. But the membership entity, this Berkshire Hathaway, whatever the example might be, would be a taxable entity in the state of Alaska.
Even if they were an LLC, not part of the big LLC, but
if they were a single member LLC that becomes a member in this LLC.
Yes.
I think that if the single member, you still have an entity that is owning the LLC, and I believe would still be subject to tax in the state. Because the distributions would be running through two LLCs.
And, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
what I'd like to do is if you could provide to us the language in there that is going to require, is going to tax that LLC, because there's no other LLC taxing authority. So if you have that in the contract that says that any member of the LLC will have to pay taxes, corporate income tax, on the distributions, then I just want to make sure that we...
Through the chair, we'll get that. Dan Dickinson and Robin are working on the PPT. Otherwise, they would have been here to give more detailed information. They will be available at other times. We just couldn't get them in today to walk
okay.
through.
This is Bob Leffler in Washington. I just want to say I've joined the call, and I'm available whenever people want to ask me questions.
We've got questions on corporate income taxes. Bob, is that something you'd want to comment on?
No, sir.
Okay. We're going to get to you in just 1 second. Representative Crawford on the LLC question. No? I'd follow up the same information that Representative Seaton wanted. I mean, I own an LLC. The LLC pays no taxes. The income from that flows to me. I pay no taxes. So if my LLC that I owned bought out ConocoPhillips, which, you know, if I bought out ConocoPhillips' portion of the mainline entity, would then the state take a hit? Because Conoco is paying corporate income taxes on the income from the mainline LLC, but my LLC would not because I don't pay any taxes.
I'd be, Mr. Chairman,
if you could answer that question eventually, I mean, tomorrow would be very good at 8:30. When will we meet it again? But there are more questions on the LLC. Let's go back to Mr. Leffler was here. Talk about question four, local use of gas. And Mr. Leffler, I'll leave it up to Mr. Seaton, or Representative Seaton, to start the question on what we had on kind of how it flows with the open seasons. Representative Rammers had a question on if Fairbanks needs to ramp up as they become a gas economy over a decade or even 2 decades, and they'll slowly need more, but they don't need more at open season breaks. How does that get addressed under any contract? Actually, it doesn't matter if it's this contract or any contract. How does that work, just practically speaking? I think is more of the question, because I don't think it's germane to just this contract. No matter what you do to get gas, you're going to have the same problem. But if you can walk us through how that works, that'd be great.
Okay, I've prepared some notes, and I've been warned in advance what the questions are. I'll try as best I can to address them, and then just follow up with me. I'm on a speakerphone. If I'm not coming through clearly, I'll pick up the handset, but please tell me if you can't hear me.
Oh, no, you're doing just fine.
Okay. I'm going to walk through the normal sequence, the open season, after the open season, what happens after the pipeline is operational, because you got to look at the question at each time. What the contract requires is that the project complete a study of the needs for gas in-state before the open season. That's an improvement on what the federal legislation required, because they had it at a much later time. So the very first step is that there will be a study either done by the state and adopted by the project or done by the project that identifies what the estimated in-state needs for gas are. And I think as you think about that, one of the parameters of that study will be when will gas be needed and what the ramp up would be. Will any be needed to begin with? And it's better to have knowledge in the beginning, and you can sort of tailor the circumstances of tariffs and expansion and even design to those needs. So step one is this study of in-state needs before the open season. Number two, the contract requires that the project consult with the state on the locations for taking gas off inside Alaska. So that's sort of step two. Another step is that the project shall fund up to four offtake points in Alaska. And it's clear when you think about it, but the point there is to get as much as possible the offtake points in Alaska designed into the project to begin with before it's up and running, so you don't have to deal with you know, tapping into a live pipe and things like that. Now, the requirement is they fund up to four, but beyond that, there may be additional ones agreed upon or even required by FERC. Another part of the contract is that the project is the main line. It is not the laterals that would feed Fairbanks or feed wherever. And the laterals can be owned by anyone, but the project is required to cooperate with the sponsors of the connecting pipe in terms of the flange, the interconnection, and we added that to the contract. What happens then is you get to the open season, which anyone's guess, but it might be a year and a half to 2 years from now. And at that time, the FERC regulations require the pipeline to offer two different categories of service. One category of service is the long haul out of the state to Alberta or wherever. And the other service that is to be offered is a service for in-state uses, in-state deliveries. And that, of course, should correspond to what the in-state study tells about where the gas is needed in-state. And so in the open season, the pipeline will offer a rate for service in-state. And the important thing about that rate is that the regulations require that it be defined in terms of the costs that you incur inside Alaska to deliver gas and not the cost of taking the gas long haul out of Alaska. So there's two separate kinds of tariff offered, two kinds of rates, and then when they come to evaluate the people who have put in bids for those rates, the bidding evaluation for the in-state service is supposed to be separate from the bidding evaluation for the out-of-state service. I want to stop there and clarify a point. People can bid according to what the pipeline offers for in-state service, but you're also able as a bidder to suggest you need different service, that you might need service at a different point, or that you might need service even that would start up 5 or 10 years after the project begins. So you could make your own bid into the open season. It would be, to be fair, non-conforming with the what's offered by the pipeline, but the pipeline would be required to evaluate that. So the first critical juncture is this open season, and you know, we'll know something, but we won't know everything at that time about what in-state needs are. And it may be that needs will be defined well enough that at least we could identify where the offtake point we want or the offtake points are that we want, and maybe even some preliminary notion of how much gas would be needed. Now, as a general matter, the pipeline at these open seasons is offering shippers' rights. It's offering the right to transport gas from X to Y. It's not offering the gas itself, so it's a separate question, which I'll get to on where do you get the gas to ship down to the in-state needs? The next thing that happens is the pipeline that assembles all these bids and awards capacity to people according to the most valuable bids, but it has to look at the in-state bids separately. And if it gets enough long-term bids, it takes those as part of its financing and puts it into its application to the FERC. Now, it is a requirement of the FERC regulations that if someone wants to make a late bid and has a good reason for that, that person can submit a late bid for capacity, and the pipeline has to consider that. And that might have some value because as the needs become clearer for Fairbanks or anywhere in state, because circumstances develop after the open season, there is the option with conditions of putting in a late bid. The other thing that is likely to happen is the pipeline probably will design somewhat more capacity than a 100% fit with the bids because it wants to have some flexibility later on. If it designs in too much extra capacity, the FERC general rules require that it bears the cost of that extra capacity and can't put it on shippers. So, to recap, you've got the open season and the requirements of the contract and the regulation designed to identify in-state needs, in-state service, in-state tariff. And you could say, and then you've got this other late bid. And then the question is what the project must do, even if no one bids successfully for in-state deliveries. And I'll quote what the FERC said, and I had to refresh my own memory, but it says, there is a continuing obligation for the prospective applicant to leave provision for such in-state service available in its tariff, but would not have to voluntarily propose it as part of its initial application. So that's sort of a placeholder for later service. Once the project is up and running, what happens when someone comes along later who doesn't have in-state transportation rights and wants to get on the project? There are about three or four different possibilities. One is there may be extra capacity because it was designed in extra to begin with, or because people release capacity. Another possibility is there would need to be an expansion. And as I said, the last time I was in Juneau, there are three different kinds of expansion, but that's another possibility. Well, those are really the two principal possibilities. So you're looking for either the pipeline to have capacity or a shipper to release capacity, or lastly, for there to be an expansion. The contract does provide for something called state-initiated expansion, which is designed to deal with an expansion where people just can't get capacity and they have gas to ship.
Mr. Leffler?
Yes.
Yes, I've got a question from Representative Crawford.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was, and what I was getting at yesterday was, in the contract there's a provision that says that none of the entities are required to sell gas in-state. But every time I've mentioned that, they've always said, well, the state's going to have 20% of the gas in kind, so could fill those needs that are going to be in-state. Is there ever would it be detrimental to the state at any time to sell that gas in state? Would the other shippers make more money by sending it to Alberta than the state would by fulfilling the needs that are in-state to NSTAR and to other entities.
Let me answer that in two parts, and I do have an answer. The first part is the amount of gas the state will have is 20%. A rough calculation is that 800 million cubic feet per day, which is four times the current amount of in-state use, according to some numbers I've seen. And so, yes, we heard that in the negotiations. The state's going to have all this gas, and it can sell it. The next question is, what price would the state want to sell that gas? That's going to be for a future state administration to decide, but you asked whether they would make more money taking it to Alberta. Not necessarily. The people who ship to Alberta have to pay all the costs to Alberta, so they pay more to ship it there. And so whoever sells it to NSTAR, for example, should be able to knock off the price in Alberta, the cost of shipping it beyond Alaska. So that's number one. Number two, the question of whether the seller, the state selling gas, would want to reduce the price even further to meet in-state needs is a question that a future state administration will have to sell. But if you believe that it's all based on a netback, so that the price in Alberta, for example, is the market price, you would not, if you were selling in Alaska, you could make as much money, if you wanted to, by knocking off the cost of transportation to Alberta and selling it for that lower amount, but it would work out the same as a seller of gas. Does that help?
That helps, but also, if we're 20% owners of the pipeline, we take a portion, or maybe even someday all of our gas off here in Alaska, will we still share in the profits of taking the rest of the gas down the pipeline to Alberta? Or because we've taken our gas out, will that just go to the other shippers?
We get our 20% regardless. It's not TAPS, which is set up a different way. What will happen is all the revenues on shipping that the pipeline earns go into one pot, and we get 20% of that pot.
No matter whose gas is.
So the fact that we took our gas off in Alaska doesn't affect what share of the total revenues of the pipeline we get.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Leffler?
Sure.
Representative Seaton.
Hi.
Thank you. Mr. Leffler, so we're looking at page 5 of the bill here, and which requires that modification does not impair the ability of the approved qualified project or the state to meet the reasonably foreseeable demand for gas within the economic proximity of the project during the term of the contract. That's on page 5, starting on line 13, item C. So I just want to get clarification. So this provision of law would be fulfilled by the terms of the contract that you are that you've just related. Is that correct?
That's my opinion. I don't have the bill in front of me, but listening to it as you read it out, it seems to be an exact copy of what is 4382.224. So I don't know that we're modifying anything but restating existing law, and B, it's my opinion that the requirements of the law are satisfied by the contract.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Leffler? Okay, thank you very much. Bob, we will have questions as we go down the road, I'm sure. So.
And I'm available, and just send me a call or an email, and I'd be happy to answer them. And if that's it, I'll let you go on to better things.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
I think we've gone through the questions for the administration right now, and Representative Ledoux.
I've got a question on section number six, on section six, line 29.
Page?
4. Deleting timing and notice provisions. That's making it broader rather than limiting it, isn't it?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Ledoux. The intent, the original intent of 220 was restricted to the right of the commissioner to negotiate changes to royalty in kind rules and royalty valuation rules. And this particular set of amendments broadens that to deal with the ability to negotiate modifications to other portions of an oil and gas lease agreement and unit agreements and what have you. So this is a broader authority that is being sought.
Follow up? No?
I don't have a follow up on this one, but I've got a follow up on question number 2. And I guess my follow-up on question number 2, where it says that the administration does not view the fiscal contract as allowing for any material amendments. Is this simply the administration's moral view of the contract, or is it a legal view of the contract?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the view of the administration is that the taxing power is a legislative power by Constitution, and that you cannot delegate that to the state administration to change that. That we don't have the constitutional authority, and it's very clear through the Stranded Gas Act. And I think if you look at the discussion when the legislature added legislative ratification and why they added legislative ratification to the original Stranded Gas Act, it had to do with the taxation powers and the need for the legislature to weigh in on taxation. And so we do not view the administration as having the ability to negotiate tax rates to change this. However, we went back into researching it, as good attorneys do. They said, you know, I could certainly make an argument that the contract allows it, in which case somebody could try it, and then you could go to the court and see what the Supreme Court says. And so what we've done is recognize that provide a comfort factor. There is a solution to kind of do a belts and suspenders and say very clearly you can't do it.
The chair will be offering that amendment tomorrow. Representative Ledoux.
Could you give me an example of where it says that the fiscal contract doesn't allow for any material amendments? What you might view as an immaterial amendment?
I believe the general provision to allow for amendments to the contract would deal with things like there's an article on administration of the contract, who you notify, when a dispute begins and that sort of thing. And if parties, if some of the interests are changed, if ConocoPhillips is purchased by another entity, if ConocoPhillips sells its interests to another entity, all of these amendments would be administrative in nature to make sure the project goes forward with the new entities.
Just follow up. The answer to the question, though, talks about amendments to the tax-related provisions, material amendments to the tax-related provisions. What you are mentioning would seem not necessarily to the tax-related provisions. So I was just sort of trying to get an idea of what an immaterial change to the tax-related provision might be.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I can't think offhand of an immaterial change to the tax PILTS. Possibly the substitution or the creation of a new political subdivision might require redistribution of some of the PILT payments. That might be considered administrative. It doesn't change the overall obligations of the parties under the contract, but it redistributes the payments made by the producers to other entities. That might be viewed as, again, immaterial or administrative type amendment to the contract that wouldn't affect, again, the total obligations running between to and from the parties.
I just kind of get worried when there's any, you know, wiggle room for changing the tax provisions.
Mm-hmm. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, again, the language we've proposed would not have a materiality standard. It would simply say, if you're changing a tax provision, it would be subject to reauthorization by the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On that same section, taking out, I mean, before it read things that you were addressing about timing and notice and all, but we've taken out timing and notice. And so it now reads, may develop proposed terms for inclusion in the contract that modify provisions of the applicable oil and gas leases. What does that include now that we've taken out that you can change timing and notice provision? Now you can change any provision, and what is anticipated as the provisions that you intend to change that are other than the timing and the notice provision?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, what I was referring to earlier is the provision for contract administration and notice under Article 30 of the contract, and this is really kind of a standard provision for when parties enter into a deal. There are, you know, names and addresses of officials of each corporation that have to be notified when something happens within the contract, and so it's really, who do you, let's say a telephone number changes, or an address changes, or headquarters changes, or the name of the company changes. These are the types of administrative questions that I was referring to.
Follow up. But what I'm confused is that's what we're taking out on line 29. We're taking out timing and notice provisions, and we're leaving in now the it will read that you can develop proposed terms that modify provisions of the applicable oil and gas leases. No longer does this sentence read that you're changing the timing and notice provisions. Now you're changing other provisions of the oil and gas leases. And what I'm trying to do is find out, I mean, this change must have been made for a specific reason, since the examples are timing and notice, and we've taken that out. So what I'm trying to do is figure out what are the provisions to the oil and gas leases that this will now allow modification to?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, again, we've provided a general answer to that question in paragraph three. In paragraph or question and answer three in the document we've just submitted, this outlines the primary modifications of lease and unit agreement terms that are presently incorporated in the proposed fiscal contract. The deletion of the term timing and notice in on page 4, line 29, that you're referring to, again, is a specific reference to the royalty in kind, royalty in value provisions in which the state has to provide several months' notice before it changes the format or the form in which it receives its royalties. This deletion of this doesn't affect the deletion of this particular timing and notice was, again, a consistency edit to make it clear that
not just RIK provisions can be modified by the contract, but other provisions in the oil and gas leases and unit agreements. Now, perhaps what your question is, with the modification that we're proposing to 4382-435, the issue might arise, well, what if the future administration wants to make further modifications to oil and gas leases that are not in the current proposed contract? And the answer would be this legislation would allow modifications of those terms in subsequent years without coming back to the legislature.
And so would that allow changes in royalties, for instance? I mean, are those modifications to the oil and gas leases that were, or are those separate?
Well, Representative Seaton, through the chair, under the proposed contract, the state has agreed to take its royalty in kind, and so there would be no opportunity to like renegotiate royalty valuation methodologies, for example.
So, just one further follow up. So, your testimony here is that what would be allowed under this new provision applicable to oil and gas leases are all contained in question number three here, the response to question number three?
Representative Seaton, my testimony is that the answer to number three is a summary of the primary modifications to leases and unit agreements that are contemplated by the existing proposed fiscal contract. To the extent that there's an amendment opportunity provided in Article 39, and you're foreclosing the use of that amendment opportunity for tax pilts, the issue remains whether or not some royalty provisions, further modifications of lease agreements could be entered into subsequent to the authorization. That would not be addressed by this legislation.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, yeah. I guess what I'd like to do is, I don't want to get too much into the contract. I mean, we're modifying the law here. So what I'm trying to do is find out, with the modification here in Section 6, taking this out, can you give us a list of those modifications that would be possible to oil and gas leases under this new language that we're changing on Section 6, starting at, well, that whole section, that A, line 20.
Through the chair, we'll provide a more detailed explanation of what the possible is, the parameters, as well as a more detailed explanation of what is in the contract that we think we need the authority for.
Great.
So we'll do both.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. Just following up on Representative Seaton there. Seaton, on the last sentence or number six, it says provide an optional alternative for royalty in kind of certain sliding scale royalty leases. Does that mean that you can change different progressivity rates or amounts, values?
Through the chair, the progressivity rates, I believe, are related to the PPT negotiations.
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
Right.
I think too many things falling. We got some people are going to come up in a second and explain number six in terms of what's actually in the contract. It is not the net profit share leases. I got the nod no when I said that. So anyway, are there any other questions for the administration on the questions that we asked or on the bill? And they're not going anywhere. So if not, if you guys can hang out for a minute, and if I could invite Mr. Van Tile and Ms. King.
We have like 2 or 3 minutes.
Sure.
Go to the bathroom.
Sure. Take a brief Eddie's. back to order and call the meeting back to order for resources. For the record, all committee members were in attendance for all of the meeting. And also, we've been joined by Representative Newman. Yesterday, we had asked some questions of the industry representatives on kind of the practical applications of how open seasons work and how you would do a ramp up in a community. And I believe that Co-Chairman Ramirez had the questions. And I think, generally speaking, not in this contract, but in any contract, how does it work when you have a community that has to start at nothing and they're going to get to gas without being able to do it all at one time? How do you do that? And the second question I'd like you to address, since you gave me the nod that I was completely wrong, is on question three that we gave to administration subset, or number six, under question number three, to provide an optional alternative royalty rate for certain sliding scale royalty leases. If you want to start with maybe the in-state uses, maybe follow up on the conversation that we'd had in my office earlier, just for the public and for the other members, and then we go into number three.
Representative Samuels, thank you. I'll begin and then
okay.
Have
your name for the record.
Wendy come in after.
Correct you?
My name's, yes. Then I get 2 minutes for rebuttal. My name's Dave Van Tile. I work for BP. I'm the commercial manager of the Alaska Gas Group for BP. And I'd be happy to try to put a bit more context on the conversation we had yesterday about in-state use, various options available to folks for providing an unknown in-state demand. First of all, we had the benefit of Bob Loeffler's testimony walking through the general process. I thought Bob did a very good job of outlining how the open season process works and whatnot. One of the things that Bob mentioned was that an LDC, or a local distribution company, what we call someone like an NSTAR, that distributes gas from a main system to the local communities, would have the opportunity to talk to the pipeline at the time of the open season and see if they could get a specifically structured service, which we agree with. That's commonly done. The one bit of, I guess, a different twist I'd put on what Bob said is that consultation can actually take place before the open season.
So that conversation would take place, let's say, between NSTAR and the pipeline company, or NSTAR and somebody who actually owns gas? All three. NSTAR would have to talk to both entities.
Representative Samuels, I imagine NSTAR would be talking to both entities. What I was referring to was specifically there's a process within the FERC construct whereby the pipeline company has to make itself available to potential participants in the open season prior to the open season on a consultative basis. And that would be the first opportunity that an LDC would have to make its wishes known, so that perhaps during the open season the pipeline company may offer the specific service that a local distribution company had in mind, rather than during the open season saying, you know, I have something different in mind that's not the service that you're offering. It may actually already be kind of pre-stitched before the open season. There's, I think I have a list of eight options that may be available. In no particular order, I'll just kind of go down and we can talk about each one of them. Some of them are variations on a theme. One option is the most kind of straightforward, is that the local distribution company could go ahead and buy whatever its ultimate anticipated capacity demand might be. Let's say in the case of a Fairbanks Natural Gas, they would come and say, well, ultimately I think I might need 100 million a day. I don't know if I'll need that right away, but ultimately I will, so I'll go ahead and contract for 100 million a day of capacity. And then any amount that I don't use, maybe I only need half of that today, I could then release that back to the pipeline, and then the pipeline would auction it off to others who might be interested in that capacity. So that's one option that an entity might have.
Senator Seaton.
No, that was auctioning off or offering back the capacity or not the gas?
Yeah, Representative Seaton, these are all talking about the capacity. Yes, that's correct. Another option, then the options 2 and 3 on my list are actually related, and I think Bob mentioned this. One is that the entity could negotiate what's referred to as a seasonal transportation services agreement, or some people call it structured capacity, where you say, I don't need a block of capacity, 100 million a day for 20 years. I need, maybe I need 10 million a day for 2 years, and then I need to ramp it up to 20 million a day, and then 50 million a day. It can also be, that's kind of on a chronologic basis. It could also be structured seasonally, where it says, in the summer, I don't need so much. In the winter, my peak demand, I'll need more. So that the entity could negotiate a seasonal transportation services agreement or a structured capacity agreement. There's a couple ways they can do that. I mentioned one. Another is to negotiate a transportation services agreement that has a limited term and then has renewal rights built into it. So they say, well, I'm going to need so much capacity. I only want to get it on a relatively short term because I can only see so far in advance, but I want to be able to renew it. And when I roll it over, some transportation services agreements also have a built-in an increase. When I roll it over, I can roll it over into an increased capacity. I upped for 20 million a day for 2 years. When I roll it over, I want to have the right to extend it and double it, for instance. And those options are available on transportation services agreements. Also, a local distribution company could negotiate one that allows incremental increases at the shipper's option. So it's not necessarily a structured capacity because it doesn't have a structure. It just says, I might need incremental capacity. And for that option to be able to call on that incremental capacity, then that local distribution company would pay a premium for that option. But I believe we haven't penciled out all the services because the pipeline company doesn't exist yet. But I believe all of these services would be cheaper than purchasing long-haul capacity all the way to Alberta to accommodate the same thing. Another option that a local distribution company would have is to contract with a third party that has capacity, either on the open market. People buy and sell capacity just like any other commodity in the capacity release market. Another option that wouldn't necessarily require a purchase of additional capacity or a structured capacity agreement would be simply taking advantage of a service that's often offered by pipelines, particularly pipelines in northern climes, and that is called authorized overrun service. And the way that works is a pipeline will offer for firm transportation service what it's confident that it can make available kind of any day of the year long term, you know, for 20 years or whatever it might be. What my engineers have told me is that often what's done is they'll look at a warm summer day with one compressor down. You know, that's what I know the system can deliver, so I'm confident I can, as a pipeline, that I can offer that as firm transportation and that I can deliver that day in and day out. The fact of the matter is the pipeline oftentimes has more capacity than the FT that's taken out, and the pipeline will generally, Alliance is a classic example of that. That's a pipeline that's running from Alberta into the Midwest United States. They offer an authorized overrun service to the extent the pipeline performs better than the FT that's available. There's additional capacity. They'll make that available to the firm shippers at only the cost, the incremental cost of moving that additional gas, which is very nominal.
And that would, in cold weather, that would be better. You'd have more.
Absolutely. AOS is authorized overrun service.
So wind is Fairbanks, seasonal. Wind Fairbanks would actually need the gas. It's actually be beneficial because you'd have the capacity to ship them the gas.
That's exactly right, Chairman Samuels. In general, authorized overrun service, you have more of it in the winter. Compressors work more efficiently when the gas is cold, when the outside ambient temperature is cold. Presumably, that's when peak demand might be in a place like Fairbanks as well.
Senator Seaton.
How much, in a buried pipeline like this, how much fluctuation do you have seasonally like that in a place where you got permafrost and all that?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. On the buried portion of the pipeline, the temperature is, it's a carefully designed system. I guess my boss likes to call it the Goldilocks design. The temperature always has to be not too hot and not too cold, not too hot to warm the permafrost, not too cold to make it colder, to freeze it, but just right. It's the ambient temperature. The compressors that are compressing the gas are going to be located above ground, outside, or in enclosures, whatnot. The ambient temperature, though, impacts the efficiency of the compressors. Another service that a pipeline company will offer is called interruptible transportation. There may be times when, again, the pipeline has additional capacity beyond which is held in FT or even AOS, which they might make available, but it's basically callable, that if someone else needs that capacity, then the person buying the interruptible transportation would that capacity would get called from them. They'd be able to make use of it in the meantime. It's generally less expensive because it's got a call. Someone else has a call right on it. And lastly, and Bob had mentioned this, another option that's available is an overall expansion of the system itself, in which case there would be a follow-on open season, and folks like local distribution companies would be able to, I guess, to go through the process again and state their needs and bid for capacity accordingly.
So these are all of these options that you just listed now be negotiated with each individual shipper or the pipeline company, Alliance Pipeline. What do they do? Do they have like a menu of options, and the customers can, as long as they give some notice, say I'd like option B, option C, something along those lines. How does it work practically? Who makes those decisions? The Pipeco does?
Representative Samuels, yes, the pipeline company will make the decisions as to what sort of service it offers. However, any customer also has recourse with the regulatory body, so in this case it would be with the FERC. If a customer felt like the pipeline company was not offering a reasonable service that it reasonably needed, then another avenue is that party could go to the FERC and say, basically, make them offer this service. It's, here's the reasons why it's reasonable, et cetera, et cetera. And Bob also mentioned in his testimony the possibility for someone even after the open season, and this is an absolutely unprecedented provision in the federal open season rules for this project, that someone after the fact can come and say, gosh, I didn't get my bid in during the open season, but I know a little bit more now, so now I want to bid for capacity. And that has to be given due consideration. Okay. I'm sorry.
Nope.
I guess a couple of other points that are related. And Bob, again, did a good job summarizing the various provisions in Article 9 of the contract that relate to how we facilitate getting in-state gas through offtake points, doing an in-state need study, having a mileage-sensitive service offered for Alaska, requiring cooperation with local distribution companies to bring that gas in-state. One thing I wanted to mention, and it came up yesterday, I forgot to mention it then, there is some language in Article 9.4 that says that no party is obligated to provide gas for in-state use. I think that's been mentioned a couple of times. The provision actually goes on and says, but any party may supply. And I know BP as a company that's interested in bringing energy to customers will certainly compete for any opportunity to supply gas to customers. So while the contract doesn't specifically require it, it's a business opportunity, and we'll compete to be able to supply that business opportunity.
Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I
and be careful to thank you very much for your 8 options. We received a critique of the contract from Jim Barnes, one of our consultants at Barnes and Cassio. And one of the references that he makes is, he says, in the absence of some supervening agreement, the primary driver of each project entity will be the profitability of its business. And so what's difficult in this issue that we're talking about, all 8 of those options, is that there is risk, and risk always has an economic cost. And it's hard to, at this point, to quantify what kind of a premium has to be attached to the not only the conversion of a market for a consumer, but also nature of converting an economy from one fuel source to I can't remember, Wendy, what you said yesterday. It was such a good word. Would you call it alternative?
I should probably say first, for the record, Wendy King with ConocoPhillips, fuel switching.
Fuel switching, and that's really what it would be, in along the whole, you know, Delta, Valdez, Fairbanks, whatever any of these takeoff points are, and this fuel switching is going to have a significant premium for the user that's separate and apart from a discussion about a subsidy of, you know, to get cheap gas or to cheap oil, which we all know is a misnomer and is never going to happen. It's unconstitutional anyway. There is, in those 8 options, there may be some that cost more, have a higher premium, and some that have a lower premium. Would a study, question, would a study be able to rate those things and determine which had a lower premium for the end user? Because converting that premium into the equivalent of a tariff, almost a fuel switching tariff, if you will, as we, you know, it takes 10, 15, 20 years to do the full transition, some of those options are going to be more expensive and some of those options are going to be less expensive. And this is part of the problem with PIPECO and the contract, is who's PIPECO looking out for? Are they looking out for the consumer, or are they looking out for, you know, is PIPECO part of the, you know, Alaska Natural Gas Company or whatever the larger entity is? And then I have a follow-up.
Okay. Representative, or Chairman Ramirez. I do believe during the study that will be done before the open season, that will be an opportunity to look at not only what the in-state needs are, but how they might be satisfied and how various options might reasonably satisfy the in-state needs. So I think the first answer to your question would be yes. I think during that study, that would be a apt time to make an estimate of what those different capacity options might look like. I guess I'd emphasize that any sort of that analysis would be an estimate, because it, by definition, it would be before the open season, and ultimately that service will be offered by the LLC, by the pipe. You had a follow-up?
I'm not going to ask it.
Okay.
It was a good answer, though. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Go ahead. I was going to respond to the you had a second question on the sliding scale NPSL leases.
The question 3 on the number listed, number 6.
Yes. There's I guess I'd start by responding to the specific reference to sliding scales versus NPSLs, and then maybe talk a little bit about what's in the contract.
Okay.
The NPSLs actually will be left unchanged by the contract.
How many? What's the percentage of the leases that have a net profit share on them? I mean, are we talking in the margin somewhere, or 1 or 2%, or is it 40% of the leases? Or?
It's a small percentage. I would say it's a single digit percentage. I don't know.
Okay.
Specifically. I don't know if you do, Wendy.
I don't know specifically. I know it's a small number.
Thank you.
Yeah. I know BP has a handful, and it's literally a handful. There's three different types of what we call in the contract incremental royalties. There's a fixed royalty, and that's the rate that's on the lead, you know, 12.5% at Prudhoe, for instance, an eighth. On top of that, certain leases have a different kind of an incremental royalty, and there's three different kinds. There's a sliding scale lease, and Wendy's going to speak a little bit more to the details of those. There's net profit shares that have a certain, like a step up in the royalty rate once payout occurs. And then there's supplemental royalties also, and that's what exists at North Star. The contract provides for conversion of sliding scale leases to a fixed royalty percentage. And I don't know, Wendy, if you want to.
Yeah, I'll jump in here. On the 12.2C in the contract, there's a conversion in there for sliding scale leases, and I'll highlight that ConocoPhillips has a few sliding scale leases. The way a sliding scale lease works is, at least the ones we have, are that it is dependent upon the price of crude, what the royalty rate is. And the royalty rate could vary a little bit with the price of crude. And what we've got in here is a conversion.
What's the range?
I actually don't have that off the top of my head, but I know the provision that's in 12.2C was pulled as a provision, and the reference price is directly from the lease. And all what we've said is, for example, like Colville. Colville is an asset, Alpine, an asset that we've got a couple sliding scale leases over in that asset. There may be a point in time that we want to produce gas from that field. And in the RIK world, if you've got a variable royalty changing with time depending upon the price of oil, it's hard to book capacity for that. We don't know for sure how much is going to come. So what we put in here was an option to say, if we decide to produce gas from that field, 6 months, we'll go grab what the historical price has been for those previous 6 months, and you have the option to convert that to a fixed royalty percent to just facilitate fixed royalty in kind coming up in time.
Industry has the option, or
yes.
The state has the option?
Well, your guess.
It's upon notice by a producer.
Okay.
So it's our option to say, we would like to convert this to a fixed royalty percent, and here's what the price has been. There's a methodology clearly outlined in here using the same price marker that would have been within the lease provisions to just convert that over. And it is for a small portion of leases, as I highlighted before, and that's specifically the reference in here is to 12.2C, is to facilitate converting those sliding scales over to a fixed royalty rate percent.
Thank you. And mm-hmm. And so that's a 12-month look back at prices from whatever time the industry decides for that lease that they want to start production or even just apply at any time during the lease?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, there is a requirement in here that you actually have to be able to deliver gas from that asset within 365 days of making that notice. So it's not like we're going to pick a time frame and say, well, we're going to hang on to that price range and keep it out there for, you know, 20 years before we actually deliver gas. What we're saying is we know that gas is being imminently delivered from this field, and we want to go grab whatever the price is at that point in time and do this conversion at that point in time. But it is directly linked to being able to produce and deliver gas into the project within a year of when that notice is given.
Okay. Yes.
And what term was that in? 12 what?
Article 12.2C.
Okay. One more? Okay.
Chairman Samuels, if I may, I just wanted to add a couple other points with respect to back to Chairman Rammers' question. Yesterday, I think I mentioned to a couple people, part of the reason why we continually bring up the issue of the open season, and I just wanted to highlight this point. If we know that there's going to be offtake at that initial open season in state, we account for that in the design. The engineers will account for that in the design, and that is why I sometimes have used the term telescoping. That's not exactly an accurate term, because you probably won't change for the order of magnitude of the volumes that we're talking about. You won't change the pipe size, but you'll change maybe your compressor stations at different places along to accommodate some offtake in state. So that's exactly why a mileage-sensitive service prior to that initial open season can offer a distinct cost advantage, and that we designed that from the very beginning. And so I just wanted to kind of highlight that point to make sure it was clear why there was a difference between the initial open season and afterwards. Then the only other point I would have added to Dave's and Bob's discussion on the topic was the authorized overrun service. There's a provision in the contract, Article 8.8, that ensures that if the pipeline chooses to offer out authorized overrun service, that's allocated out on a non-discriminatory fashion. So if the state is holding 800, 900 million a day in the pipeline of firm transportation, the state will have their portion of authorized overrun service just as we would have our portion of authorized overrun service. And that authorized overrun service provides flexibility to any shipper to have some additional volumes during cold winter or additional capacity during cold winter months. So just to highlight back to the provision in Article 8.8 was the only addition I'd make.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Would it be worthwhile as we explore this that that we should specifically address that authorized overrun service, that it should be directed toward in-state service first? Would that be worthwhile directing, the shippers to do that?
Chairman Reimers, I think that would be decision for the state with respect to your capacity holdings. Do you want to, how you want to manage any AOS that would be offered would be a decision that you as a state capacity holder would have.
Yeah, just to echo what Wendy said, I think it's up to each individual shipper to determine how it uses its capacity to be able to match its markets, to meet its gas supplies, and that would include its use of authorized overrun service or IT, interruptible transportation, if it was made available. So I would think that's most appropriately an individual shipper election.
Okay. Thank you. Any more questions? Representative Seaton.
Good back up just a moment to the conversion sliding scale. Does that have to be done at the initial startup of the field, or can that be done at any time?
The Representative Seaton through the chair, the conversion itself is upon notice from the producer that you're actually going to be able to deliver gas within a year. You can make the conversion any time, but if you haven't produced gas from that field within a year, then that provision would go away. You'd have to re-notice again if you haven't delivered gas within that time frame. So it would be when you actually anticipate that you're producing gas from that field is when you'd make that notice.
Done. I've got a follow-up for you. You're an engineer, right? Okay, and you'd be the perfect person for this question. When you go to AOGCC, how long the process before you, what was the name of the field where you have a net profit share, Coalville?
Coalville, we have a few sliding scale leases, and I should emphasize these are one or two, handful of leases,
I mean,
okay?
The whole thing is about a handful of leases. So when you go to AOGCC, how does the process work to determine we're going to start taking gas from there as opposed to from X to Y? And does AOGCC get involved with that? Does the state, I mean, is it a two-year process to get them the permission to start taking it out of a certain reservoir?
Representative Samuels, Chairman Samuels, the process with AOGCC, typically what AOGCC will do is establish pool rules for an entire field to set a maximum efficient rate, let's say, of offtake. I know at Prudhoe Bay we're going through that process right now to have that revisited. For instance, we're going to go through that process at Point Thompson. So they'll set a maximum efficient rate for the entire pool, and then under that, those guidelines that are set by AOGCC, the operator of each unit will provide a plan of development that has to be consistent with DNR's regulations as well as the regulations set by AOGCC.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up also?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Which provision in 2004 here are we talking about as far as the sliding scale? I have lost it. And then I guess what we're saying is at any time during the field, let's say a field that has a sliding scale agreement that was producing and you were doing everything, and at any time during its production life, the producer could apply to say, okay, we want to look back and convert this at that time? I mean, it doesn't have to be at the initial startup of the field, is that, or of production, is that correct or not?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, you could conceptually do it at any point in time, but you haven't solved the problem then. It's definitely linked to the deliveries of gas. So, for example, Alpine's producing oil right now and it does not have a gas offtake plan at this point in time. When you think you're going to be producing gas from a field like that, you would send your notice for that provision, and then you would have to deliver within the 365 days the actual gas produced from that. I would struggle as to why you wouldn't do it right when you would start think you're going to start gas production, because the very issue you were trying to solve is capacity doesn't work on a variable basis. So if I'm fluctuating how much royalty gas there is with oil prices, it's difficult to manage the capacity and the total production from the field. So it would seem to me you'd always want to try to exercise this option. If this was your choice to exercise this option, you'd want to do that right when you start producing gas.
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. The section in HB 2004 is Section 6. It's the language that we've been talking about under 4382.220A as amended, that provides for a broader revision to the terms of the oil and gas leases. And this was an example of one that would be necessary. And just to emphasize Wendy's point about the whole reason we created a defined term incremental royalty in the contract and set that aside from fixed royalty was to facilitate this whole capacity management. The incremental royalty is going to be the gas taken in kind. NPSLs that have an incremental royalty above the the fixed royalty is the gas taken in kind. The incremental royalty that's above the fixed royalty would be paid in cash, specifically to avoid the problem of as they vary around. Yeah, how do I handle capacity that's, you know, 1 month it's up, 1 month it's down?
Thank you. We're going to adjourn, and tomorrow morning we can have public testimony at 8:30. We can also, if there's not a lot of public testimony, we can have time for questions. You will both be here at 8:30 tomorrow. We'll make sure Mr. Jardel is here, and then what we'd like to do is, after session tomorrow, is get to the amendments on this bill and just keep moving down the road on the amendments. So I don't know how long session will last. It'll depend on what happens up in House Finance today. But the plan for tomorrow is we'll start at 8:30. We'll go as long as we can with public testimony or more questions. We had some questions from Mr. Jardel. He can get us the answers back tomorrow morning.
10 o'clock.
Floor session is at 10 tomorrow. And then if the floor session is only reading a bill across, and we'll come in whenever we can. If we go late tomorrow, we will just recess and
go all night, Mr. Chairman. Let's go all night.
Come in with Plan B then. We'll see how tomorrow goes first. But 8:30 tomorrow morning, we'll start with public testimony. And if there's not a lot of public testimony, we'll have more times at that time for more questions for the administration. And I certainly appreciate you guys' input here on the kind of the practical implication. With that, we're adjourned.